Welcome to the 10K Collective podcast. Listen, if you want hacks, my friend, I'm afraid you're in the wrong place. Our philosophy has grown out of the 10K Collective London Masterminds. Members, by the way, make between $500,000 and $7 million a year in e-commerce, mostly on Amazon. Many have doubled revenue in the last 12 to 18 months. If you're that kind of person, this podcast is made for you. We're not puritanical. We use hacks. We just don't think you should focus on them if you're building a real business. Instead, we focus on what's been proven to work in the group. Real brand building, clear strategic objectives, courageous long-term goals, and long-range thinking. If you like that focus, keep listening, and welcome to the 10K Collective. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the show. This is your host, Michael Veazey, with more wonderful knowledge for advanced or at least moving Amazon sellers. This show is focused on those who already have revenue and know how to do the basics and want to grow and are ambitious. And one of the things you need to do is money, because this is an inventory-based business, and that means it's capital intensive. And there's many discussions that I've had at the 10K Collective Mastermind where one of the major topics is, how do I get more money to fund my business? So the man to deal with that is Bruce Mack of Platinum Financing Group. Platinum Finance is a financial consulting company that primarily finds clients. And Bruce has a huge background in this stuff. He's a financial advisor. He's a speaker, a trainer. He was even a banker in his past life. So incredibly qualified to talk on the subject. So Bruce, warm welcome to the show.
Thanks so much, Michael. I really appreciate being invited to your show, and look forward to chatting with the folks that are on the podcast and what have you, and give them some great information that they can take to the bank. Pardon the pun.
Oh dear, bad puns already. It's that kind of show. Sorry, folks. Yeah, well, I like bad puns. It's good. I like it. So, Bruce, tell us a bit more about yourself. I mean, I know you were just sharing with me that you've just been skiing and you had a bit of a sports injury, but of less than an exciting kind. So, and you're a man of action. Tell us a little bit more about yourself and your background. It's a bit of a fuller figure for Bruce the man as well as the financier.
Okay, so now you're already starting. I think we're into this now for, 20 seconds, and you're embarrassing me. I'm already probably turning red in the face. So I was telling Michael, he said, how's things going? I said, well, I said, to be honest with you, I think you call it a bum, right? My bum is killing me. So is my left hand. I used to teach and race. I love to snow ski, and it's my passion. I mean, we all do it for a reason. And my reason, or my why, is to be able to take a day and cut work and live the laptop lifestyle and go and do and be where I want to be. And where I want to be when there's snow is up in the mountains skiing. So I was up at a place called Mammoth Lakes, California. It's about five and a half hours from Los Angeles. And the mountain is fantastic, and they just had over 3 feet of fresh new snow. And I wanted to time it right, and timing it right meant after one storm and before this next storm coming in. And that meant I go up on Saturday and I ski Sunday and Monday and beat it back to the office by only cutting work for one day. So I'm up there and I'm having a good time. And I'm not falling. I'm just, everything's good. I'm walking right back to the car. I'm in the parking lot. I see that car. I'm 10 feet away from the car. And the next thing I see is I see my feet going right over my head.
There was good stuff.
The parking lot was a sheet of ice. And I fell on my arse.
You fell in your bum. Yeah, I suppose, we do say that. So getting back to the point there, so you're obviously a man of great action, and, unfortunately, some of the action in the car park, less than exciting. But I love the fact that you're a very physical, entrepreneurial people are often like that. It seems they're very sporty and very goal-oriented in their hobbies as well. A lot of other people that I know to be massively into cars and car racing, drag racing, whatever it is. So, fantastic to meet somebody who's got some passion for life outside of finance. But so tell us a little bit more about the whole topic of finance. So the first thing is to say that it's a big, big need that I come across repeatedly. And the bigger the sellers, ironically, the bigger the need for money, because a lot of people miss that at the beginning stages. They think, oh, the better my business is, the less money I'm going to need. And sure, that can work that way. But tell us a little bit about your experience, first of all, working with e-commerce sellers or physical product sellers generally. How does that need for funding manifest itself?
Well, that's a great question, Michael. I've been in the financing arena for decades and worked with countless thousands of people, helping them either with startup capitalization needs and or existing businesses with cash infusion so that they can take their business to the next level. We work with a lot of different verticals, but a couple of the verticals that we've found to be that are big niches that we've been able to be extremely successful with that particular type of individual has been real estate investors, because there's an ongoing and chronic need for money for people that are doing foreclosures, for people that are acquiring properties, for people that are, you know, they just always seem to need a lot of money. Another major market niche that we've been extremely successful with is working with FBA types of folks, people that are in your space, people that are buying and selling on Amazon and or eBay or what have you, because the interesting part is that I keep getting told from the students that we work with is when you find and you're able to data mine out, what have you, a winner, one that, you know, a object that is clicking and that you may want to take an offshore it or what have you, it's how quickly can you get your product to market and how can you get as many of those widgets, gadgets, or gadgets that you can get and warehouse them so you can send them out. And if you can't get those widgets, gadgets, and gadgets in the warehouse to be able to send out, then that's lost opportunity cost. And it's an unfortunate thing because the FBA world moves so quickly that you need to be able to capitalize on them as quickly as possible. And that's one of the things that cash and cash infusion can make such a focal difference in, is to be able to get the inventory that's required so that you can make the sales, so that you can make those great margins.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, if you put your finger on the key word that I heard from that is opportunity cost. I think that's one of the things that when people go out of stock on Amazon, and one of the reasons they might go out of stock is undercapitalization, because, you know, there's a few reasons they may not have predicted demand, etc. But often people are stingy, if you like. They're cautious with the amount of inventory they stock because of a lack of cash. And thus, they miss out on out of stock. And if you're out of stock on something that's selling $10,000 a month, and that's quite small for the Q4 in Amazon.com in America, certainly, then, you know, if you're out of stock for 3 months, that's $30,000 of lost sales, plus all the lost ranking or the lost reviews you could have been gaining. In the meantime, your competition is doing all the rest. So 100%, I mean, this is a major, major, major block to a lot of people. So yeah, I think you've got your finger on the pulse very much with that. Let's get into some details. And first of all, let's deal with the question, because a lot of people listen to the podcast. This is a new venture, so I imagine if it reflects the amazing FBA podcast. And by the way, this is kind of a blend, because I won't want people to know to completely run away from amazing FBA. It's still me. It's still the same kind of set of contacts, but the focus is different for 10K Collective. But we don't know, but I imagine it'll be a lot of Americans listening and a lot of Brits. So let's differentiate between what the things you and your company can help with Brits with and the topics you know about. First of all, can UK-based individuals get funding at all in America if they're wanting to expand their FBA businesses there?
Oh, okay. The answer is yes, we do have a program for Brits, as you put it, that would like to be getting money to drive their business forward. We have a corporate credit program for individuals, and they can live in Britain and continue their business in Britain. And there's a little twist to that. The twist would be that they would establish a business, which is very inexpensive, establish a business in the United States, and then we can get them credit. We can get them generally speaking, well, our guarantee is to get them a minimum of $50,000 worth of credit. And that's a minimum guarantee. I've seen in many cases us getting 100, 150 or more for individuals. And the reason that we can do it is once they have established a business, we can use that as a threshold to begin to getting open lines of what's called trade line credit, and then build upon that until we get other types of credit so that they can use that type of credit for open to buy. Matter of fact, we even, one of the clients that we get people credit with is actually with Amazon. So that's interesting as we go through the credit building process with the individuals. So the credit can be used anywhere in the world. It's strictly a simple scenario of establishing a business domestically to be able to start to do the credit building process. And it has nothing to do with what's called here in the United States, one's FICO score, which is their Fair Isaac score, which is their credit score. And it also has nothing to do with their social security number. So it is totally, strictly based on their EIN, which is their employer identification number, and how we go about building that type of credit from ground zero.
Wow. Okay. Interesting. So let me just reflect a few things back. I've grabbed a pen and started making notes on a notepad here because I was thinking, I always try and focus on the interview and not be fiddling around with notes, but I know that I've got to get my head around this, and that helps my listeners to get their head around it as well. So first of all, trade line credit. So that's let me just check one thing first, because this is obviously a critical distinction between different flavors of debt. Is that dependent on putting your personal property, like your house, as collateral? Because obviously that can be one of the big things that makes a difference to a loan.
Sure. And that's a great question. People oftentimes ask me, they say, well, is the credit that you get for your folks secured, or is it unsecured? The types of credit that we're going to be focusing on for today's call are all going to be what's considered to be unsecured, meaning no security pledge, meaning no collateralization and or cross collateralization. Everything is done on a signature, and that's the only way that we would be discussing, or that's the only type of, I should say, credit that we're discussing and or funding availability. Nothing to do with any type of collateralization.
Yeah, because I mean, obviously it's going to be a lot harder for anyone to police that. And if they've got UK-based residents and they had to personally come over and repossess their personal property, that could get tricky. So yeah, interesting. I mean, that's certainly music to people's ears. And normally a loan, in my experience with most of the 10K collective members or people of that ilk, if they're going to make a substantial loan over, say, $100,000, it tends to be collateralized. Although I must just double check, what is cross-collateralization? That sounds like a terrible disease. What is that in real life?
Well, you never would want to catch cross-collateralization because it spreads, right? It's infectious.
No. What does it mean in English, in normal words?
In English, cross-collateralization means, well, let's just talk about it from a real estate perspective. This will be a good example. Let's just say I want to buy a property, and I've been told that not only do I have to have good credit, but I have to cross-collateralize or pledge, sign a note saying that in the event that I do not make payment on the new property that I'm getting funding for, that you are given the right to take one or more of my other properties that I currently own. So that's using collateral as a way to securitize the credit that's being given to you. And this could be other things other than real property. I've seen cross-collateralization work with things like people's jewelry collections, stocks, bonds, and other types of equities and or valuable items. So it doesn't necessarily need to be property, but in most cases, it usually does mean property.
Okay, interesting. Right. Yeah, so that makes a lot of sense. So it's another way basically of it's security for the bank, but not for us as the lender.
Exactly.
So, okay, that sounds like good news. So to summarize then, you could probably lend a Brit at least 50,000. I say Brit, and I know what to call people, UK-based people. I mean, you know, whatever the right word is, people in the UK. I mean, they're going to be able to get $50,000, possibly more, 100, maybe even 150,000 unsecured funding based on a trade line credit. So just to clarify, what is trade line? Because I think one of the things I want to get from an expert like yourself is to get people an overview of the terminology that they need to understand, you know, your perspective as a lending person, and to start to speak the language and know the different nuances. So what is a trade line as opposed to, say, a line of credit? Presumably it's a special type of a line of credit. And how is that different from, say, a credit card?
Okay, well, let's start off with talking about the program I started to jump into, which is the corporate credit program. The basis or ground level type of credit that folks are getting are trade lines. Companies that are here in America, such as, oh, let's just take Uline. They're an office supplies company, and they will pretty much open up anybody who can fog a mirror if they have the right credentials, which, of course, we help people get the right credentials, and they will be given several hundred dollars worth of credit. And a client, which we teach, well, when they're assigned out to one of our coaching staff, they're taught to make some minimal purchases. And of course, to make payments on those, because what ultimately is going to happen is that the person is going to start to increase what's called their Paydex, which is their Dun & Bradstreet, and IntelliScore, which is from Experian. Those scores are going to increase over a period of time based upon their payment track record. So when they get their open to buy, they make a purchase, and then they pay on that purchase. And they pay on that purchase within the first 10 days of receiving that notification. Now, that's critical because these corporate credit companies look to see when you pay. With a credit card, you don't get anything good or bad happening if you pay your credit card bill when you first get it. Actually, the only thing that happens that's bad is if you pay, make your payment on a 30-day payment after 30 days, then you get hit with a derogatory because you have a 30-day late, but you get no reward for paying early. That's just not the case with corporate credit. They actually have a tool that measures that if you make your payment within the first 10 days of the invoice on a net 30 basis pay, you actually get the credit in that case of being what's called and rated as a prompt pay, as opposed to the next bracket, which is that 10 to 30 days, which is a paid on time, and then the last bracket, which is a late pay. So we teach everybody to be a prompt pay. You get extra kudos for being an early or prompt payer, and that's a good thing. We show you how to takes these trade lines and stack them, and over a period of several months and repeated making minimal purchases, you then move up to the second level. The second level being things such as store cards for places such as Amazon, where you can buy anything and you'll be getting a multi-$1,000 open to buy. And this is a great thing to help you ascend towards getting the final goal. And the final goal is to be able to get credit cards that are $2,500, $5,000, $10,000 credit cards or more. And this is where you're at the highest level. And then you can be utilizing those cards for making inventory purchases to fuel and push and move your business forward at a rapid pace. That program is totally different from a couple of other programs, which I'm delighted to share with you if you want me to, Michael, but those other programs are really for domestic-based people because they do need to have a FICO and a Social Security number for those other programs, okay, though those programs are extremely powerful to that audience.
Great. Well, let's address that. We definitely want to address that. But let's just draw together what you've just been talking about and let me reflect as a sort of, I suppose, informed amateur. I'm certainly no professional in credit, but just to make sure that we've understood and give people a chance to absorb this. So basically, we've been talking about corporate credit program, which applies mm-hmm. to companies based in the US, and the people who own those companies can be based in the UK or the US or anywhere else. Is that a fair summary?
Yes, but many of the corporate credit building blocks, those trade lines, are domestic companies, but some of these companies that people will be getting credit with are international in scope. So it really depends. It really depends. And that's one of the reasons we have been successful with people that are foreign nationals that want to get going with corporate credit.
Great. Okay. Well, so that's, in other words, it's going to be a worth getting in touch, if in doubt, get in touch with you guys or a similar type of service. I mean, obviously, you guys know masses about this stuff. But just to summarize, there are basically three types of credit. There's the corporate's trade lines, and it's really critical and very, very helpful information to know how they get classified by these lending companies. So basically, you pay within 10 days, you pay within 30 days, or if that's what you've agreed is your payment term, or you're late. And so it's good to know that you get rewarded for early payment. And then the next level up is the store cards and things like that, and then credit cards, which is, by the sound of it, much more flexible because you can pay up to the latest payment date without any penalty. So that's a kind of summary in my understanding. Is that accurate? Is there anything to tweak of that?
Again, no, I'd say that you're really spot on. I mean, with credit cards, you've got a 30-day basis open to make payment. And with corporate credit, though you can take up to 30 days as you're trying to establish a credit, and these are invoiced bills that have a what's called net 30 basis, meaning you have to pay it within 30 days. It's not a revolving line of credit like a credit card is. So again, we just caution people as part of the training process that you want to put your best foot forward so you get the highest and quickest possible positive ratings. And one of the ways is I tell people you get an invoice, you pay the invoice. It's that simple.
Yeah.
That way it just doesn't go into the standard payment, and certainly not doesn't slip into being a late payment.
Yeah, interesting. So in a way, what it reminds you of as an Amazon seller is that basically in order to make profit down the line on Amazon, we need to feed the algorithm that Amazon has. And everything's driven by an algorithm, right, these days, with the odd human intervention occasionally. But I know from my conversations with friends of mine who've worked in the financial sector in the UK that basically most of the decisions are made by a credit score or some equivalent process. So basically, you're feeding the algorithm as an Amazon seller to try and get Amazon to rank your products. And then over time, when they do that, then gradually you can increase the price and stop spending so aggressively on Amazon ads or whatever your traffic source is. And it feels like a similar process to me. I mean, this is less familiar to most Amazon sellers, but it feels like the first thing to do is to please the algorithm. In this case, it's the lenders, build a profile that says, yes, this is a good person to lend to. And then gradually over time, then we can start to make that payoff in a more serious way. So that's my Amazon seller centric understanding of the, coming back to a familiar process for us. So very interesting.
Totally agreed, Michael. Actually, and to add to what you're saying, there's a ranking, just like you said, and it starts off at zero, and zero is just as zero does, it's zero. And then 100 being at the pinnacle or at the top being the ultimate best ranking that you can get. And anything that's an 80 or above is a very solid ranking. And that's what we're working for. And that's what we're working towards, is working with the client to get them an 80 paid X and IntelliScore or better ranking in as few months as possible so that they're going to have more credit offered to them.
Excellent. Well, I mean, I think what's interesting to me is that I meet Amazon sellers. Obviously, I meet people at all levels, those who wish to sell and those who are, the million-pound mastermind, I guess. I don't know, a couple of people are doing, say, $6 million, $7 million a year equivalent. So not vast businesses by the wider scheme of things. But what's interesting is that they're normally very patient about being willing to spend a lot of money and effort just to rank for keywords for products because they know the value of that over time. And I guess what we need to educate ourselves on is the value of credit over time, and thus to have the similar level of patience to build that rather than just banging on the door of the bank and kind of hoping. So, which seems to be the strategy that even some reasonably robust sellers use. So this is more sophisticated strategy, makes a lot of sense. So listen, let's move over to what you were calling the domestic. If you're US based, that would be you, or if you're UK based, that would mean US based people, because I know you have some other programs that you educate people in there. So tell us a little bit more about what's available to those folks.
Well, we've got several other programs that, depending upon who the individual is, might be a perfect fit. So let me start with, if I may, our revolving lines of credit program. And our revolving lines of credit program has a really, really great tagline. Our tagline is 0% APR, that's annual percentage rate paid, 0% APR for up to 21 months on that program if you qualify. And qualifying is really not that difficult. If somebody's got a 700 or better FICO score, and ideally they have at least one or more credit cards that has a $5,000 credit limit, and currently their utilization on their credit cards and their store cards is at 30% or less on each of their cards, likely they're qualified to go through that program. Now, somebody might say, well, you know, I'm not there. I have a 620, I have a 630 FICO score. Darn it. Well, don't despair. You'll still want to see if we can get you to qualify, because there are some if, buts, and exceptions with that. Let me give you some of the if and the buts. We actually have an external funding department to pay down people's high utilization cards so that they get their FICO scores to go north or increase. So FICO penalizes people greatly. A third of your entire FICO score is derived from credit utilization. And once you start creeping over the imaginary brick wall, and that imaginary brick wall is at 30% utilization, once you start creeping over that imaginary brick wall, unfortunately, FICO starts to penalize you and your credit scores start to erode. Let me give you an example. Imagine, first of all, that you've got a $10,000 credit card credit limit. And let's just say that you've bought a lot of product and therefore you've used credit cards and it's at 70% utilization, or your current today's balance is at $7,000. That's 70% utilization. And that would absolutely disqualify you today from going through the program, because as I said earlier, you need to be at 30%. So what to do? Well, you can rob your own bank account and or try and find funds to pay down your card so we can get you into this program, or depending, we will take a look at the account and likely lend you the money so that you can pay down your credit cards. And over a 30-day period of time, your FICO score will go through the moon and you'll end up with a FICO score above 700 once those payments have reflected and you've got your utilization ratios down into the conformity of 30% or less. This is a great program and an excellent way for us to be able to work with individuals. The other question people oftentimes disqualify themselves on, Michael, is they say, well, my situation's different. I had some, you know, I had a bankruptcy. I had a charge off. I have a lien. And those are still on my credit report, because credit reports reflect information in most cases for 7 years and in certain cases up to 10 years. Now, it was in my past. but it's affecting my FICO. Let me say that we have an attorney that we work with. I used to own a licensed and bonded credit repair company, and there are no exacts or guarantees in credit repair because you can't make them. However, I've never seen an individual have more successes consistently removing inquiries and bankruptcies and any types of derogatories that there could be, collections and charge-offs. The attorney that we work with is magical. She's very inexpensive. And that's the other way that we can go about increasing your credit scores so that we get you to where you need to be to go through the program where the average client gets funded $75,000 to $80,000 in a matter of weeks from the time that we get them put through, as much as $150,000 on a first round. And then we can come back and do a second round months later where we can pick up as much as another $100,000. So this program can get over a period of time an individual as much as $250,000+. We've seen this time in and time again.
Great.
And it's a great program.
That sounds extraordinary. Yeah, I mean, that's really going to move the needle because the people, if you're selling $500,000 a month or something, you want to expand, you're needing to look at numbers in the hundreds of thousands. So that would actually really move the needle. So that's a pretty significant result, to say the least. So let me just reflect again, just go back over what I've heard, just to make sure that I've understood. And that's to
get, and then we'll move on to the other funding program that we've got. I want to share that with you as well.
But fear please. Not, we will cover everything. But I just want to make sure that people can absorb this, because I was fine with anything technical, certainly with internet marketing stuff. It's familiar to me from that now. And whenever I go out with somebody new, however bright they are, it's just, you forget, oh my God, this is a steep learning curve. So let me just reflect. So broadly speaking, we're looking at revolving lines of credit. So the difference between that and a term loan, I guess, is you take some money out, you pay some back, you keep taking some out again, you go back and forth. So the crucial thing is the FICO score. First question, just remind us what FICO stands for or means, especially for the non-Americans amongst us.
It's the Fair Isaacs. Oh my gosh.
It doesn't matter. Like, you don't need to remember what it sounds like. It's basically your credit score, right? It's not anything.
It's the American credit score. There are many, many different models. There's the Vantage score. There's the this score. There's the that score. But it is your score from the three different bureaus, TransUnion, Equifax, and Experian, and that is the credit score that one has.
Okay, so broadly speaking, to put it in simple terms, it's kind of your Experian credit score, but obviously not just Experian. But okay, fine. So yeah, very interesting what you were saying about the credit card thing. I mean, it reminds me actually of the old advice about speakers. Like, if you want to have a really good quality speakers at a concert, because my background as a musician, I've done the odd sort of gigs like that. And mostly it was classical piano. But so if you've got a massive amp system and you only use a certain percentage of that power, you get a very good quality experience. Whereas if you're running it right to it's like redlining a car, you're going to damage things quite quickly. I guess that's probably a better analogy, right? So it sounds like what we need broadly is high credit limits and then a modest utilization of them at any given point. Is that a fair summary?
It's a very fair summary, and I really like the analogy. FICO and the credit scoring companies get very concerned once you have high utilization that you're going to blow yourself up, get major distortion, and not be a good pay because there's too much financial pressure on you, which is why they start to erode your score once you get over 30% utilization. And we happen to have a fix for it. Like I said, we can lend clients the money to pay down their cards so that their scores will zoom up so that they are not affecting their current business. It's a solution, and it's been a really, really good workaround. But I couldn't agree with you more, Michael. That's a very good analogy.
Well, that's very flattering of you. But I mean, I was thinking also it's a bit more, I mean, more realistic. It's a bit more like a car, where if you're redlining it all the time, you're just going to shorten the life of the car. It's going to be an unpleasant, bumpy ride. Any passenger you got with you aren't, like, if you're a professional taxi driver, you wouldn't get your aren't people coming back. And I guess if we treat the lenders as a core part of the business, which I think we kind of need to because the money's so critical, then we've got to give the lenders the kind of ride that they want, right? And if they want to feel like you're going along, your car could do 7,000 revs per minute, but you're going along along at 1500, smoothly cruising along, and that they keeps them happy, then that's, I guess, a mentality, again, that we have to adjust to in our business. And again, it's almost like a mentality shift for Amazon sellers or any entrepreneurs, because we tend to be pedal to the metal, as you would say. It's another car metaphor. And we tend to want to rev everything to the max. We burn ourselves out in terms of working 16-hour days. We put all the money in, we mortgage our house, whatever. But suddenly we have to kind of be aware of a different mentality in relation to money with the lenders, it seems to me. So it's not just mechanics. It's also more like a mind shift that we understand. People come with quite a different mindset where actually burning the midnight oil is not always good.
I would totally agree with you. Would you mind if I shared, just going on that and taking that a little bit further, would you mind if I share a strategy that's going to help your clients not burn themselves out on their FICO?
Yeah, sure, of course.
Okay. So there are some newer scoring models that some of the credit grantors are adapting. And in those new scoring models, they are actually tracking the amount of utilization that clients are keeping themselves at chronically, and they're getting penalized if they're consistently revving, as you said, or redlining, and always at a high limit. Now, again, I told you, you can pay down your cards and your score is going to go up, but with some of these new models, if you're chronically redlining month in, month out, that can have a damaging effect long term to your FICO. So one of the things, and my tip is pretty simple. My tip is get business cards that don't, and because all business cards, but with one exception, do not report on your FICO. So if you want to rev and do the red line, which I totally get, let's do it strategically. Let's do it with business cards that don't report on your FICO. Keep those utilization ratios up at 60, 70, 80, or 90%, and it will not affect your credit score at all. And conversely, try and keep your personal cards at 30% or lower as much of the time as possible, and you're going to end up having the best of both worlds.
Nice. Now, so basically, you have just going to double check. Sorry to interrupt. I just want to just reflect back, just make sure that everyone's got a chance to absorb this stuff. Because, I mean, some people might say, yeah, it's obvious, but a lot of people are going, whoa, let me just get my head around this. So basically, a business card, as in the card in the name of your business, your LLC or whatever the entity is, you can basically redline those with some degree of impunity, i.e. the FICO score will not be badly affected. But any personal cards, you basically keep below 30% utilization, and then you're safe. Is that a fair summary?
In a perfect world, right. that is absolutely the case, which begs the question, when we work with people, not only do we give them this education, but we go one step further. Many of the clients that we work with, even though they're in business, they may not have a business entity. And one of the things that we can do, and one of the things that we help with, is getting them an entity so that we can get them the business cards that are attached to the entity so that they can redline all they want on those business cards, which, right, by the way, also usually get approved at a 10 to 15% higher straight across the board, open to buy or credit limit. So there's a secondary reason that we love to go after those business cards.
Okay. Yeah. So higher credit limit. Okay. Makes a lot of sense. So thank you for letting me sort of reflect back on that. I just want to make sure we can absorb this in sort of absorbable chunks. So that's the revolving. So that would that be the revolving lines of credit program that you then offer?
That really summarizes revolving lines of credit program that we've got.
Uh-huh. Super smart. Okay. Super smart. That's so American. I've been speaking to so many Americans. I'm becoming Americanized here. But that is very smart. I love the fact that you know where the red lines are, if you like, or the do not cross lines are, and you just step carefully around those and maintain that precious score. So it's just like Amazon ranking. It's just the same kind of mentality, actually. It's like whatever you do, you look after the ranking, and that kind of then everything else good flows from that, it seems. Thanks for listening to the 10K Collective podcast. I really hope you found the show helpful. I mentioned the London-based masterminds we've been running since September 2017. Members of the 10K Collective Mastermind make a minimum of about £480,000 a year, well over €600,000 or dollars. To find out more about that mastermind, go to amazingfba.com/10KC, K for Kilo, C for Charlie. £1 million mastermind members make a minimum of £1.2 million a year. That's about $1.5 million US or euros. To find out more about that mastermind, go to amazingfba.com/MPM. That's M for mother, P for Peter, M for mother. Thanks for listening.